Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
Welcome back to Radio Gorgeous, Zoe Williams.
Thank you for having me.
We'll always have you. since you were last on, I understand you were married.
I did get married, yeah. I mean, it was a bit of a surprise to me that it came around, to be honest. I thought we'd kind of gone past that bit of momentum. But apparently that's still a thing. And I had a feminist wedding.
Which, what is it? What is
that means? That means you don't wear white. And when somebody accuses you of having waited 10 years for that moment, you give them a dirty look.
I'm with you.
That's a feminist wedding.
I had two feminist weddings.
Well, congratulations.
Same weekend, but yes. But did it feel different?
I don't know. Do you feel different?
I did.
Did you?
I did.
Did you? I think maybe I feel a little bit more taken for granted. And also, I still haven't really thrashed out. If you don't change your name, are you still allowed to call yourself Mrs.?
People call me Mrs. all the time anyway. Because I didn't take my husband's name. Because it's a ridiculous name. And so, of course, something comes addressed to the Shelmerdines. And, of course, I couldn't pick it up at the post office.
Oh, God, how annoying.
So what I brought was I had my driver's license. I had my marriage certificate. And two bank statements in our joint name so I could get my package.
But I think this is a good opportunity for you to just dodge administrative tasks.
You have to take a day off of work.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, darling. You're on because you've written another incredibly well-researched, intelligent book. You know, a ploy others have used to get back on Radio Gorgeous. But, you know, in any event, you're not unique. Tell us about why we have to get it together.
Right. So I really noticed if you look at politics, right? Mm-hmm. Politics, why do people despise Westminster? There's all kinds of reasons given that which are all about the identity of the people in it. So it's like they're all too white. They're all too middle class. They're not middle class. They're quite posh, mainly. They're all male. They're all this. They're all that. They don't really represent the country. And I get that. I get all that. And I get that in order, if you want to kind of really make a change, then your power structures have to reflect the interests of the people in the country. They can't just reflect those interests. But I do not think that's why people loathe Westminster. I think the simple fact is that they're not really answering the questions that we're asking anymore. Or if they do, they answer them in a very circumscribed way. So, you know, if you look at tertiary education, suddenly students have to be left with £50,000 worth of debt if they want to do a degree, which is a major deal to live your adult life, starting with that. And then the left-wing answer is, oh, we'll reduce it back to 6,000. Now, that actually doesn't make a huge amount of difference. When you say to Labour, that doesn't make a huge amount of difference, they get really uppity and like, well, tell that to the people who are £9,000 richer under Labour. You and your ivory tower think £9,000 doesn't matter. You're like, no, I don't think £9,000 doesn't matter. I think somebody should be making a moral case for tertiary education being free. But similarly, housing, you've got a kind of, They offer like 200,000 new houses or 500,000 new houses, but never any kind of structural ideas for how to stop housing outstripping wages, which is what housing does. And then if you want to talk about wages, there are never any really full-bodied ideas for rebalancing the industrial sector in favour of wages against profits. So you've got these people occupying the kind of representative seat of power. And they're telling us that all the questions we're asking are unanswerable, that basically this is the modern way. So the modern way is that you'll probably rent for your entire life. The modern way is that education is no longer free. The modern way is that wages is that you might spend the first 2 years of your career working for nothing. And even when you do get paid, your pay won't cover your rent. So we've got a kind of concept of modernity, which is really a rebalancing of power in favour of wealth. And it's that simple. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason people are angry with politicians is because they're occupying the space that we used to use to change things. And they're telling us things can't be changed. So I've got a huge amount of sympathy with people who go, oh, I've got no time for any of them. The truth of it is, though, how did we ever change anything? We changed it by getting it together. How did we ever invent building societies? We did it together. How did we ever get wage parity? We did it with unions, and that is getting it together. So yeah. There's a huge, huge global and historical precedent for people in a coordinated way making massive changes to their society. But you do have to do it. You can't wait for somebody else to do it.
Well, see, because the problem with what you're saying is that I don't get to blame it on immigrants.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, and I have to do it myself.
Yeah, no, I know. And that's the problem. But the funny thing is that the immigration thing, it sounds like an easy answer because you get Nigel Farage saying, you know, if we kicked all the immigrants out, there would be no housing crisis, there would be no wage crisis, there would be no crisis event. All the kind of bucolic picture of English life that we remember from the 50s would be restored. But I don't think people like the idea of that either, because if they really follow through, they're talking about isolating, they're talking about kind of closing the skin of the country.
Well, my basic question is, when has the last time when people voted out of fear turned out real good?
Yeah, exactly.
You
exactly.
know what I mean? Like, when fear is the motivator for voting? Show me a positive example of that.
Yeah, and on the
that
same...
That was inclusive and up with people and what we really want.
Exactly. And I mean, exactly the same tip. When did demonizing an other, whether that's foreigners or poor foreigners or Jews or whoever, when did that ever turn out well? And I think people know that, you see. I don't think people really want to turn against their neighbors. I don't think they really want to stop people coming here. I don't think people really want the kind of close-minded, narrow life that would entail. And I don't think they want the cruelty that would entail.
No. But what you're saying is that we're required to think. It seems to be.
Well,
seems to also be in short supply. People like these short answers.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Can we take a specific example like the NHS? Mm-hmm. Does it need rethinking? Does it need, you know, and it seems sometimes it's another one of these issues that people get frustrated with because there's a binary narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can only talk about you're either for it or against it. It's frustrating to even think about. I mean, I think I should be able to give the NHS a tip.
Yeah, they
shouldn't count on that money. But, you know, like a good waitress, I'm all for rewarding you.
Yeah. I mean, I quite like the principle. I think there's a sad kind of stuckness of civic institutions. Mm-hmm. The thing with the NHS is that the Conservatives use this disaster narrative, and they use the disaster narrative as an excuse for pushing through what is essentially kind of profit motivated change. Mm-hmm. But the left, They hear the disaster narrative, and the only way they can respond to it is by saying, no, this is really great. They can't say, they can't allow any room for doubt, because otherwise they're conceding to that point. Now, they're right in a sense. The NHS is fabulous. You know, it is, across the OECD, the best healthcare you'll get for the amount of money you spend. The health outcomes that you actually are getting from this brilliant institution are superior. They're superior, obviously, to the American system, which is really, which is kind of perverted and bloated by corruption and overpricing. But it's also superior to things, to kind of insurance-based systems in Europe, because basically you waste a lot of money in insurance-based systems working out who's supposed to get paid for what. I mean, you think of that as a trivial thing, those kind of transactional costs as trivial. They're really not trivial. Mm. They're massive. They're like 30% of the costs goes towards working out who's supposed to get paid.
Right.
We really do it in a very economical way, and we do it brilliantly. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't respond, you know, and it does have to respond. It does have to. I think it needs to be more participatory at a kind of patient level. You need to be more involved in the delivery of your own healthcare. You need to feel, because you actually do have the power to shape your own health destiny, you need to feel like you're working in partnership with your doctor rather than he's the kind of almighty godlike figure who delivers his solutions.
However, I went in for something. Yeah. I'm a 48-year-old woman. I'm reasonably intelligent. Why the hell wouldn't I have looked up, you know, I have a long-standing
Yeah.
Condition.
And were they quite arsy with you?
Oh, yeah. When I said, oh, who told you your IT band was incredibly condescending?
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, yeah.
Why don't you want me to know more about this?
Exactly. And there's a really interesting, somebody whose name, unfortunately, has gone out of my head, said it's in the DNA of the NHS that the doctor knows everything. Because you're saying, when you say free to those who need it at the point at which they need it, who determines the need? They do.
Yeah.
And so the very fundamental basis of it, we're going to give you what you need, is we know what you need.
Yeah.
And that is the thing which has to change, really. And you know, you do hear of really far-sighted doctors saying, what we do now is ask the patient what they think is wrong and start from there, rather than assuming that the patient is a hypochondriac or a neurotic
scrounger.
We say, what do you think is wrong? Because even if they're wildly off, it might tell you how to reassure them. Mm-hmm. There isn't the parent in the country who doesn't look into what's up with their kid and worry about it. There isn't the adult in the country who doesn't at least Google what their symptoms are. These people don't. The kind of supine, floppy, confused people that the system was designed for don't exist.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You know, that there are massive changes that could be made, but I think they could be made really collaboratively and excitingly. But you do need to kind of break down some of that authoritarian barrier.
Mm. I'd love to get your take on the right to buy. And again, that narrative.
Yeah. I mean, this is really... So this is the Conservatives' right to buy social housing, right?
Yeah.
Now, the 30% of the Thatcher's sell-off has ended up in the hands of private developers. I'm surprised it's as low as that. But what you've got is those houses that people used to live in when they weren't on very high incomes, they're now worth £1.2 million. So you've got to say, where does that person whose council flat is now worth £1.2 million actually live? Especially with wages going down. And the answer is they either live in very, very squalid accommodation nearby, or they live in pretty squalid accommodation miles away. So there's a real demonstrable diminution of quality of life for those on low incomes when you sell off housing stock. And everybody knows that. This idea that, you know, everybody's life is improved when they buy their own home. Even if they have no problem, what happens to the person who comes after them? What happens to their kids?
Why not find us on iTunes on Radio Gorgeous? And then you can follow us forever.
You need social housing stock for people to live in, or you need a housing market in which the cost of the housing reflects
people could actually
average
buy
wages.
It. Yeah.
But, you know, average housing now
Insane.
Is 10 times
yeah.
average wages, and that's not even in London. In London, 0.1% of the properties on the market are affordable by a family on two average salaries. So you're in this situation where people are complete, and the Conservatives' answer is, well, this will be solved by people owning. Now, it won't be solved by people owning. And actually, part of the problem with the housing market is that when people buy things as investments, then their value goes up as investments, and the fact that people still need to have them to live in them is forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only value in the world of a house is for someone to live in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we're allowing its use value to be completely steamrolled by its value as an investment is really weird. It's really weird that we mm-hmm. would just stand by and let that happen. They start with a completely wrong premise that it's better for people to own, mm-hmm. a completely fallacious idea that they can replace one for one the housing that they sell because they don't. And also the numbers just don't stack up. They might as well just build a lot of their own stock and own it as state-owned stock from the get-go. But then the third problem is that the housing associations they're not private companies, they're charities, but they still own that stock. So the government is basically appropriating their mm-hmm. land, which makes no sense at all for a free market, you know, for a very free market government to then suddenly say, well, all this land and these properties that are yours are now mine. It's basically a kind of mass scale appropriation of property. Now, I would be in favour of that if we were talking about, say, closing City Airport, appropriating the land, compulsory purchase ordering the land back to Newham Council and then building social housing on it. I would be hugely in favour of that. I would say that was a brilliant idea. But I'm not in favour of appropriating charity land to put it through a process which will eventually end up with it belonging to a developer. I'm not in favor of that at all. Mm.
It seems to me a lot of these narratives and the discussions around them are driven by a sort of theory of if someone else has it, you won't.
Yeah.
So in terms of poverty, whether it's scroungers or foreigners or whatever, if they have it, I won't. When we think about justice, our idea about justice is better a couple of guilty people get away with it than one innocent person goes to prison. Mm-hmm. Or at least we used to think that way. I'm not sure we still do. But I think about poverty in that way and asylum seekers in that way. Better we overfeed than underfeed.
Oh my God. I mean, it's
better that we have a couple of people who are scamming things than a kid goes hungry and starves.
It's really amazing. You know, there was a story in Stoke-on-Trent about kids going through bins for food. And you're like, I cannot believe that has happened in my lifetime. I just can't believe it. Essentially, I think what we've done is we've made citizenship very contingent. The kind of mainstream narrative goes on and on about kind of benefit claimants as de facto scroungers, even if they're not actually defrauding the state.
But I don't know how they get it, because I came here, my British citizen, born and bred husband dragged me by the hair back here, but my visa was contingent upon him earning a certain amount of money, so that I wouldn't cost the taxpayer anything, and two, on my visa, it said no recourse to public funds.
Right.
So I don't know who these immigrants were getting.
Well, you're non-EU, right? So they think it's the EU immigrants. But basically, I mean, what they've basically done is they've recast the idea of the citizen as being the idea of a citizen with a job. So if you're on benefits, then you're scum.
You're not a citizen.
So if you're disabled, you're not a citizen. Yeah. If you're out of work, you're not a citizen. They kind of, pensioners have miraculously been able to escape this because they fought in the war, even though quite a lot of them didn't.
Yeah, but they're bed blockers now.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got this whole body of people, and, you know, 21% of people are on housing benefits, so the actual benefit claimants class is huge. But you've got this whole body of people who are kind of basically classed as you're not productive, therefore you're not really a citizen. And then you pit those people against migrants, and they're clinging onto their citizenship by their fingernails anyway. They're under constant media attack. They're now under pretty constant social attack. You know, disabled people report being spat at in the street. So they're under this kind of vile hostility based on their economic productivity, and then migrants are produced as a kind of displacing class. So you're like, so you've got Nigel Farage saying, well, why do you feel so worthless? Because this Polish guy works harder than you. Now, of course, you completely understand why somebody who feels like their citizenship is under constant attack would be very ripe for kind of news and neo-xenophobia. And you completely understand why a migrant who works really hard would think, well, hang on a second, it's not my fault if your country's bust. You know, you sort it out. I'm just working. Mm-hmm. But the point is we've got to stop talking about people like this, because you don't build a good society by segregating it into units of economic productivity. You just, like, that is the way to turn everybody against each other.
Yeah. And to have this idea of a finite resource that you're getting a piece of.
And it's just nonsense, because, you know, I've been productive in my life. I'm productive now. When I was having kids, I wasn't that productive.
But
when
you produced kids.
I produced kids. I'd like to see
how they're
going to...
Some people have a value for another generation.
Exactly.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
Again, I'm doing something non-monetary for the country, in my view.
Well, but it is monetary. If you're not doing it, someone else is doing it. who has to be paid.
Yeah.
So it is a monetary thing that you are doing.
But they want to get women, and actually both main parties want to get women back into the productive workforce as soon as possible. Now, I think they miss a trick here. Basically, they do get some support for that, because women do find that the kind of the raw economics of going back to work are really, really against them at the moment. You have to be earning quite a lot to justify nursery fees. It's very, very constraining as a kind of...
Sorry to interrupt, but do you find that there's a gap there? Because I have problems with where's the money?
Yeah.
Because there seems to me a gap there. Caring for children is a low-paid job.
Yeah.
So why can't I afford it if I'm being paid slightly more than... You know what I mean? I don't understand. There are some basic concepts that I don't understand where the gaps are.
I think the gaps are that it's a low-paid job, but it's often mediated through quite kind of high-pay institutions, and it's very stringently regulated. But if you're going to regulate...
Okay.
If you're going to regulate... Childcare.
Which we want, because they're taking care of our kids.
Yeah, and you do want that. But basically, in Germany, for instance, they put the money into the nurseries, and then parents pay on a rate scale according to their earnings. And that works really, really well, because A, it means you get completely mixed use, and the best nurseries are taking kids from across different social classes.
Very early.
Yeah, very early. And it really, and it opens the parents' eyes more than anything else to the fact they're not that different, you know. And B, it means that people, you know, you wouldn't have a nursery bill that you couldn't afford because it was based on your salary. And C, it means that nothing is wasted, you know. The money that they want to spend on nursery care, they spend on the kind of nursery care they want to provide. And that's really transparent, and it's...
Well, and as a citizen, you avail yourself of it as required.
Yeah.
If you don't require it, you're not availing yourself of it, so it doesn't cost anybody anything for you to avail or not avail.
So what they do instead in the UK is they put all the subsidy into the parent end, so the parent gets to choose, but then that means that the nurseries aren't naturally kind of self-regulating, because some are bound to be worse than others because they don't have that kind of interaction with the state.
Well, and also you're putting it into their profit share, because these are for-profit things. That's what I have a problem, because the UK seems to be, you know, in the States, socialism is this horrid word that equals communism, that equals Satan.
Yeah.
But it's this sort of, I find here, for the selling off of private, you know, of public stuff, you have these weird hybrids that you are, the government with our tax money is hiring for-profit companies to provide public services.
Exactly.
And that seems to me to be at cross purposes.
Yeah, and it's really, really nuts. And basically what happens is that then you do get really low-paid nursery workers, but because their skill level is not very high, then the government will kind of come in and say, oh, you need to be NVQ 1 or 2 minimum. And then, so that will ratchet the cost up. But really all that happens is that the wages are ratcheted down. So quite highly trained nursery nurses now are still paid minimum wage. Even the nursery owners are barely breaking even. We just kind of erected so many barriers for ourselves in order to have the private sector, but regulate it, but still allow it to make a profit, but not make, you know, we've erected so many stupid processes that we've actually created a very expensive system.
I do want to get to the heart of your rallying cry. And I have a question about the premise of it. Because I think your premise is that we do all want better for everyone.
Yeah.
That we have not just our own interests at heart, but interests. Really?
I love that. I love the intonation. Really? Are you sure?
Are you sure? I mean, in theory, yes.
Mm.
But if the doors were closed and I was voting blind, would I vote just for me and my kids?
Well,
do I have to vote for your kids?
The thing is,
but it is important for us to. But do we? And how do you get us to?
I mean, my feeling is very much that, you know, when you have a very me-first culture, we all come second. We all do. Mm. And you can really...
Because I'm second to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're second to me.
Yeah.
Oh, and, okay, I get that.
And it's
okay.
It's quite sad, you know, because you're right. If back against the wall, I do care about my kids more than I care about anybody else's kids. And I would, if I was absolutely forced to, kill another person's kid to feed it to my kid. End of story. No problem. But I don't think we're in that kind of end of days catastrophic situation.
No. Okay.
And what I would, my real belief is what's better for my kid is likely to be also better for your kid.
Yes.
So really, if we want to build them something worthwhile, then it would be better to build it together. Because I could build a little bunker for my kid that didn't have room for your kid. But I think they will have a better life if we've created something that they can all use.
Radio Gorgeous, pirate radio for Vogue readers.
And my example with this is tax. You've got, like, people don't really trust the government. They don't trust tax, to be fair. There's a very, very strident voice on the right saying tax as a principle is unfair because you earned it, so you should keep it, which I think is really bizarre, you know, that anybody would value money over the pooling of resources to make a better society. The idea that it would actually be better for you to buy an Aston Martin instead is just completely
Well, also, the
stupid.
Whole point is, at 50%, if you're earning £1 million, you'd still take the 500,000, would
still,
you not?
Yeah, and you'd still be fine. You'd
yeah,
still
exactly.
have a perfectly lovely life. I do see the problem with people not really trusting government, because as we see,
yes.
our public services eroded, our universities more expensive.
And the middle class does feel squeezed.
The middle class
you
feels
know,
very...
We're not subsidised, yeah. and yet we can't afford things either.
Exactly. And we do feel squeezed, and it is natural to start thinking, well... Actually, I don't trust the government to look after my kids. I'm going to have to save my ass off to get them through university. I don't want them to have this kind of debt. I think I can, with really hard work, look after them myself. And then you start to really resent tax. Now, the truth of it is, you do probably, if you've got a really good job, have enough to save for a really narrow path. So if you've got a good kid, passes all its exams, chooses a good course... You might be able to save 50 grand between now and when he's 18 or she's 18. And that's fine. But what you don't have is enough for a spread bet. So you don't have enough. Say your kid is a bit wild and just doesn't knuckle down. Or say your kid has mental health problems, which 1 in 4 people do. Or say your kid wants to do art and then halfway through the art school wants to go to medical school. You know,
yeah.
there is a million... billion different paths for a kid, which we can only plan for together. I can't make all those bets on my own children. I can only do it if we're together building decent mental health services, if we're together building decent drug services, if we're together making sure tertiary education is free, if we're together making sure housing is affordable. We can only make a spread bet together. And that, I think, is the really important thing, that actually common interest is self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
Self-interest
yes.
is not self-interest. Self-interest might look like self-interest, but the chances of you ending up on top are really pretty random. It's just a roll of the dice.
Okay, so that sounds good, you and I sitting here
yeah,
in cozy
yeah,
living
yeah.
room. Get involved locally.
Oh,
get
no,
involved.
This is really interesting. So interesting. What to do? What to
yes,
do,
Yes, exactly. So
I mean,
where do I start?
So, I mean, my in the book, I've totally... didn't even occur to me to join a political party, but
mm-hmm.
the kind of political stroke legal mind Anthony King kind of took issue with this and said members of political parties have a huge amount of power.
Mm-hmm.
Now they bloody don't in the Labour Party. All the time I've known the Labour Party, it's been steadily trying to ignore its members slightly more because it's A, it can bank on its members, so it wants to talk to other people.
It's like being married. Take it for granted.
Exactly. It's exactly like being married. So it never occurred to me that actually the membership of the party could make any difference at all, especially since there's no kind of democratic mandate anymore because they don't actually get to choose the manifesto. They don't crowdsource their manifesto. But the SNP is the story of what happens when 100,000 people join a party. It's a different party. You know, 3 years ago, they were the Tartan Tories, and now they are the voice of the progressive left in the UK. And there are people, my hairdresser wanted to vote for Nicola Sturgeon. And I said, well, you can't because you live in Balham. And then later she was Googling it just to check that I was right. There's nothing. I'm actually revising my position, and I think if a huge number of us joined the Labour Party, we could turn the Labour Party into a different Labour Party. Mm-hmm. But I also think that actually there are ways. What really changes politics is to change the temperature, and there are ways and ways and ways to change the temperature of the country. So, for instance, the tax evasion debate, mm-hmm. the tax avoidance debate, has really changed in the past 5 years. Really changed. You know, we're now all over it. We're constantly thinking, you know, there's this big gap between what we could be bringing in and what we are bringing in. A lot of that is corporate. A lot of that is high net worth individuals. What do we do about it? And the stuff is getting into manifestos. You know, it got into the Conservative budget last time around, and it's in the Labour manifesto now. You know, who are the people who've made that change? They're just normal people like us. So if you're interested in tax, there's nothing to stop you being part of the Tax Justice Network. There's nothing to stop you being part of UK Uncut. Any of these groups.
And these groups are kind of like magazines, like where fanzines used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So for anything, I mean, probably if you're interested in
then it. Then somebody else is.
Somebody else is probably interested in it. And there's probably an organization, if you Google it, that you can come up with.
Exactly.
And if not, you also can start one. Things happen because people do them.
Yeah,
and we're all responsible for being one of those people.
Exactly. And we all change the temperature. We all have a role to play in changing the way things are perceived mm-hmm. and changing what's normal, mm-hmm. you know.
And questioning the narrative.
Yeah. So right now, at this particular instance, if I said the way we create money is not working, putting it into the hands of private companies who don't have a social purpose, who just extend debt indefinitely and then leave us with the kind of growth requirement to pay off the debt, that is not working. If I'd said that a year ago, I think people would go, oh my God, what's she talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Now I can say it and people will get into a conversation. Yeah, well, who should create money if it's not mm-hmm. going to be a private bank? Should it be the government, or should it be the Bank of England, or should it be, I don't know, some new kind of crowdsourced democratic mm-hmm. body? In 2 years' time, we might actually be talking about this in a real way. And that would be pretty extraordinary.
And okay, so I'm going to ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? How and where are you involved?
How and where am I involved? I'm involved in Compass, which is like, it used to be a pressure group within the Labour Party to make it more Labour. And now it's more just a lot of people kind of getting together and trying to figure out. They call themselves a platform to create a better society. But actually what they are is a bunch of people who kind of bring in lots of different voices. So that's where you'll meet people from Podemos or Syriza. That's where you'll meet people from UK Uncut or Transition Towns or the Green Movement. I mean, you'll meet a lot of people and talk about a lot of ideas. And I think what it does is it kind of cracks open how many people there are who think like you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Zoe Williams, thank you for helping us get it together.
Thanks for having me.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com and beautifully edited by Ella Gray Thomas, 2015.